Welcome to The Social Podcast with your hosts, Melissa Grello, Cynthia Loist, Lainey Louie, and Jess Allen. Today on the show, Parenting Food Fight. Why some say judging what other people feed their kids has become a blood sport. And does a career change need to be a sudden epiphany, or can it be a slow burn? From Gilmore Girls and Sullivan's Crossing, actor Scott Patterson joins the discussion. Then get ready to get creeped out. Real-life stories of paranormal experiences. Plus, the new podcast, Humans of the House, gives listeners exclusive insight into Canadian politics. The host of the series and two former MPs join us to unpack the harsh realities of working in Canada's government. It all starts now on The Social Podcast.
Welcome to The Social. We are thrilled to welcome to the show for the first time actor, producer, and star of CTV's Sullivan's Crossing, Scott Patterson! Great to have you here. Great to have you here.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
There's just not enough energy here for me. It's just, I don't know. Well, you guys got to loosen up a little bit.
Yeah, we do. Yeah, you know.
You could lock up. You don't want to do that.
Okay.
So,
right.
There you go.
Well, Scott, we know that you are a dad, and so I think we're going to have a really fun first discussion on the show.
Yeah.
Because according to the LA Times, judging what other parents are feeding their kids has become a blood sport. So this goes both ways, apparently. So some parents report being judged for being too healthy, others feel they're being judged for not being healthy enough.
Yeah.
All right, so what's the Goldilocks moment here? Why are we so judgy about what we feed our kids or other people's kids?
No. I my comment is just, you know, get your nose out of other people's businesses.
Yeah.
And it's like, you don't know the circumstances that that child comes from.
Mm-hmm.
And if they want to eat that certain way or they can't afford to eat a certain way, why is anybody judging them, you know? And, hey, I tell you what, if I see somebody with a Pop-Tart and I got a health food thing, I'm going, hey.
Yeah.
You know, thank you very much. I mean, look at it like it's a blessing, you know? So
I love that. Sometimes, though, the judgment even comes from family members. I have a friend who has a picky eater, picky daughter. But when the daughter goes to grandma's house, she'll eat anything, essentially, whatever grandma makes. But grandma makes sure to let her daughter know, oh, so Jenny ate salmon and green beans and squash, and she cleaned her plate.
Wow.
Almost like using it as a device to guilt the mom into thinking that, oh, it's something you're doing, that you're not making the right food. You're not doing it the right way.
Right.
Yeah. Which is like, that is like mother on daughter crime.
Yeah.
Do you know what I'm saying? That's mother on daughter crime.
Yeah.
So is she being passive aggressive or what is she actually saying?
I think that's kind of aggressive aggressive.
Yeah.
Or that's aggressive aggressive.
Not subtle at all.
Yeah.
I mean, I am proud to say that my son, who's 9 years old, almost 10, he will eat a lot of diverse foods. I'll say, like, I think his default position, like many kids, is beige, a beige plate, right? Just everything.
Many adults,
right?
Too.
Many adults.
Yeah.
That's true.
Yes, beige.
But I think that's the thing that I get fearful. I guess I judge my own child because I don't want, and I say this to him, no one wants to date a picky eater. So later in life, you need to diversify.
Do you say this to him?
Oh, yeah. Oh. I do. I'm like, you're dead in the water if you cannot figure this out later on.
I'm glad.
Yeah, thank you.
Because I find it unattractive.
It's totally unattractive.
If I was dating someone and all they ate was beige food.
Yeah.
And they were resistant to like different kinds
of
food.
He's not, Scott, what do you eat?
Yeah.
Anything and everything. That's why I'm not leaning over. With I have an 8-year-old, he's almost 9, and the proud parent moment for us was getting him to eat tons of vegetables every night at dinner.
That's great.
So he can have, he loves burgers and pizza, because on burger night, I'm quite a burger chef. I don't mean to brag, but I make these thick, juicy burgers, and he just crushes them, he loves them. But he's got a huge plate of vegetables coming after every single meal, and he scarfs it down. So basically, he has free reign to eat whatever he wants. So, because we know he's going to get that salad.
I mean, you're speaking from the dad's perspective, and if I may pry slightly. I know you said off the top, everyone should mind their own business, but I'm going to get into your business.
Be careful, lady.
Is this a gender thing? It sounds like it's a lot of mom-on-mom crime, too. That it's moms judging other moms. That by saying, oh, your child only eats chicken nuggets and fries. Well, my child. Like, is it the commentary? It's not actually about the food. It's a judgment on the parenting. Is that very uniquely gendered, though?
I haven't been exposed to it, but if anybody tried to shame my wife or my kid because of, you know, some perceived food they were eating wasn't up to their standards or something, I'd just say, listen, you know, my kid eats 5 head of lettuces and 10 cucumbers and 16 bell peppers a week, so you know what I'm saying?
Wow. Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Before the show, he's like, I understand you can't swear on this show. And so that is swear still, and it's just another
different language.
Right?
Yeah.
Anyway, we're going to move on. We're going to just move on. What would you call this a red flag in a relationship, Scott?
I'm from New Jersey.
I got you.
This is not swearing.
Someone wrote to the advice columnist at the Washington Post saying their girlfriend is buying a house on her own. And they want to know if this means she isn't committed to their future. So they're dating, she goes rogue, and she buys a house. Oh, people are booing her. Is this a red flag?
Look at Scott.
Women are better investors. Women are better with money. They are more responsible. I am not saying that they're risk averse, but they don't take stupid guy risks that, you know, half of us end up broke because we got a hot tip on the stock or something like that. You know, they don't fall for that stuff. And if she wants to buy a house, okay, let's say she's in a really committed relationship.
Yeah.
Okay. And it's going to be a forever thing. And she goes ahead and buys a house. But it could be a financial thing. Maybe she's in a better position, and she probably is, because she's a better investor, right? Mm-hmm. She's better with money. Mm-hmm. And if he's got a problem with that, then he needs to deal with his problems.
I like that you're going there, Scott, because the question you asked off the top, Cynthia, was, does this mean she's not committed? In this piece, he asked the question, he is the one writing into the advice columnist saying, does this mean, you know, he gives himself up right at the top when he says, you know, I'm not sure where this relationship is going. So when you ask, is she committed? No. He's not committed. That's why she bought it by herself.
Right.
Well, they had been.
Bang.
Right.
But what if I say they've been dating for 2 years and lived separately. And then he was the one that said, hey, before we take this to the next level, AKA marriage, I think we should live together. And she said, yes, let's live together. Actually, I'm going to buy a house. So at first when I read it, I, like many in the audience, felt bad for him. But it was you plus Carolyn Hacks, the advice columnist, who sort of switched it around, because he's asking her, this is the way she put it, he's asking her to respect his timeline of like, well, I'm not too sure if I want to get married, whereas he's disregarding her timeline, which is financial stability. Mm-hmm. So it's like, for me, it's a timing issue.
Right.
You know how that happens sometimes? Like, if they were both on the same timeline, this could be a beautiful thing.
But I don't even think it's timeline, because if she really felt like he was committed and they chose to still live together, if she's kind enough to be like, yeah, fine, let's, why don't I buy the house? You move in with me. If he puts a ring on it, it's called just amend the title on the mortgage. This is an easy fix if she felt like he was in the right place.
Yeah, but I mean, it's one thing like when you go out and you buy a house together and you choose it together. It's another thing. I wouldn't want to move into a house that Jason bought. That's his house. And I think that this to me is a relationship red flag, because they're not talking to each other about what their plans are for their future.
He's writing to a columnist.
Good point. When I bought my first house, I did it with my girlfriend, who became my wife and the mother of my child. And she didn't move in right away, but she was part of the process of searching for houses in the area and then helping me to pick this one. So yeah, I mean,
felt involved.
It was involved.
But
we'd already been dating a couple of years.
Yeah. So Scott, the understanding was though she would eventually live with you, and you guys, this would be the marital home.
At least in my mind, yeah.
Oh, okay.
I had to buy a house to convince her. Hey.
You need the input, though. I agree. You need the input. Yeah. Like, when I first met Jacek, he was in the process of buying his first apartment. So basically by the time I moved in, the ink was barely dry on the ownership papers. And that apartment was, I never had a choice in it. I hated it. So it was one of those things where we got out of there as soon as we could because I had inherited with this relationship, this apartment that I had no say in.
Right.
So it is about communication. Mm-hmm. That said, did I have a say? Like I moved in, you know, like this dude, I didn't have a say. He also though assumed all of my debt.
All right.
Well then, the blood I still complained about, he assumed all my debt and I still complained about this tiny apartment and well, we're still married. It's been like 21 years, so. Is there a problem? Clearly not.
All right, we're going to take our first break here on the show. Afterward, how do you know when you're ready for a career change? We're going to dive into this when we come back. We'll be right back after this.
You're listening to The Social Podcast on the iHeartRadio Canada Network. Coming up on the show, you won't believe what career Scott Patterson had before becoming an actor. Plus, his unexpected tip on how to kiss with coffee breath. Don't miss it. You're listening to The Social Podcast on the iHeartRadio Canada Network with your hosts, Melissa Grello, Cynthia Loist, Lainey Louie, and Jess Allen. Joining the panel today, a special guest from Gilmore Girls and Sullivan's Crossing. Mel, take it away.
We have got actor Scott Patterson who is joining today's conversation. If you want to message Scott for swearing in Italian or anything, get us on social media. Just kidding. Get us on social media and have your voice heard.
So how do you know when it's time for a career change? According to the Wall Street Journal, rather being sudden or even intentional, the decision to change your profession usually involves a series of small steps, baby steps. Scott, what's your experience been like in this?
I've had a couple of different careers. I started out as a professional baseball player. In fact, the Toronto Blue Jays gave me a great offer.
What?
Very, very first offer, long, long time ago, and I turned it down.
What? Oh my gosh!
Because I'm stupid.
Oh my gosh!
Like, is this the Cito Gaston era of the Toronto Blue Jays?
But no, wait, no, it was before.
Okay.
I'm very old.
No. See,
Makeup.
Okay, so you get an offer from the Jays.
And then I went through a couple of more drafts. I ended up signing with the Atlanta Braves, played 7 years of professional baseball. But it really didn't work out the way I wanted to, and it probably would have with Toronto because they were giving young guys like me a chance at the big league level. I just wasn't smart enough
to
take it.
The sliding doors of your life.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And that's how I got into acting.
Okay. But wait a minute. How did you get into acting from there? How do you go?
Yeah.
So I took, after baseball, I went to Europe and I lived and traveled. I'd never been. I wanted to go there. And when I came back, I got into an acting class in New York and the rest, you know, I just worked, I outworked everybody.
Do you see the connection between the skill set that you learned in baseball and becoming an actor?
Just having a skill set. Because the thing that I learned from baseball is stop worrying about what you can't control if you're not advancing fast enough and just work on your skill set. Because everything is about a set of skills. Passion is a given. Talent is a given. It had better be there. But if you don't have a work ethic to hone your skill set and improve it little increments every single day, you're wasting your time.
Wow.
And that's what I took into acting. And I said, okay, this is a skill. It's a craft. I don't know it. I'm going to learn it. And I just obsessed with it and continue to be. So it's little skills every day. You pick up something every day. Yeah.
Wild. God, I love it too.
I think all of us have had kind of different careers before television, Jess. Did you?
I did. I've worked a lot of retail jobs and then I worked at a magazine. But this is interesting because when I was a little kid, I always, I'd play time by myself, Dave Letterman. And so I would be Dave Letterman and I'd interview people. Yeah. So, you know, tell me, you know, about what was it like working on this movie? And sort of put that aside. And then I had all of these other jobs. And then eventually I got hired at a magazine where my job was to interview people. And then now baby steps to this where
you're
talk.
David Letterman.
You're basically David. I'm on TV now now interviewing people. So I don't know if there's something there, but it is interesting because I enjoyed it so much as a kid. So maybe it's baby steps all
the time. So did you have your full circle moment? Did you interview Cher?
No. Oh my gosh.
You know what I mean?
That would be,
it's coming.
Yeah,
it's coming, Jess. Yeah, what do the kids say? You're manifesting it.
I'm manifesting.
Yeah.
David Letterman.
Yeah, it's true.
Oh. Okay, so Scott, your show, Gilmore Girls, was famous for...
Thank you.
Coffee consumption. So we're dying to know your thoughts on this next topic. So
okay.
Bridgerton star Regé-Jean Page confessed that he and co-star Phoebe Dynevor had horrendous coffee breath in their kissing scenes.
Oh, boy.
Was coffee breath a problem on your set, any of your sets?
Only if they had K-cups. You know, okay. If, in the morning, the, if that cake has a different taste, I could tell.
Oh my! Are you a coffee connoisseur?
Well, I have a coffee company. I mean, are you?
Yes, you are.
Sure.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
So, what's a bad coffee? Bad coffee?
All of them except mine. What kind of a question is that?
Sorry.
Have you not experienced Scotty P's Big Mug Coffee?
No.
But there is something in, like, a bad cup of coffee is, and there's a lot of times on set, it's amazing that how crappy they can be.
Well, the thing on Gilmore Girls is we were always making out with each other off set anyway. I mean, it was just constant. So when we got to set, we were like, do we really have to, like, continue this? And we'd have to wake up because we're so tired from all the kissing and all the, you know, the hoop-de-doo. And then we'd have some coffee and we'd get to make out because we'd wake up, we'd perk up.
I've always wondered, though.
I have a question, too.
As an actor.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, just jokes aside.
Yeah.
Do you, if you know you're showing up on set that day and there is a kissing scene, I know lots on Gilmore Girls, Gilmore Girls, do you do a little extra in the morning with the routine and the gum?
You mean a little chicka-chicka-bow-bow?
No!
I think she means floss.
I mean hygiene, but okay, if that's where you want to take it.
Anna. You get ready in the trailer and you're like, hello. You know, no. It's actually quite uncomfortable to do a kiss. It's very nerve-wracking.
I imagine, and there's like so many people watching.
And I there are no tongues involved ever.
What?
And if there ever are, you just go, boom, no.
Do you talk about that technique thing beforehand? Or are you like, listen, or is it just a given?
It's just a given.
It's a given,
It's just mouth kissing.
What would you do? Just like,
and then you hold your breath. You don't even breathe.
Oh my gosh. Like,
yeah, but there's lines.
You're locked up, you're free.
Wait, hold on, Scott. There are some lines where it's not just the kiss. You're delivering lines because, you know, we see you. You're delivering lines, getting
like
closer,
sweet nothing,
and like you're breathing something. Like you've got to smell it.
It's like going underwater. You're like coming in. So let's do it.
Okay.
I've always wanted to kiss you, and I've been looking at you for four seasons.
I could not be an actor.
And you're so wonderful. And then hold your breath. And then you go in. You remind me of a girl I used to date. She didn't like kissing me either. She's like...
Oh my gosh.
So it's like a shark latching on and you just grab on, you know. You hang in there until they say cut.
Right? I always thought there had to be somebody's job on set to just have like breath mints or like a spray. Like everyone's just ready because you're spending who knows how many takes that's going to take. You can't be holding your breath for 10 minutes.
Well, on Gilmore Girls, they always had a guy that had a fire extinguisher. Because things got so hot.
Oh,
and they're just, all right, cut it out. And we're doused in chemical.
Of course. Makeup
reaction.
Yeah, gotta go through the whole thing.
This conversation went somewhere I did not expect.
Me too, happy it did.
I should have worn my Doc Martens. I knew it.
Okay, on the other side of the break, we want to know, have you ever had any paranormal experiences? We'll share if we have after this. We'll be right back.
Still to come on the show, the hosts kiss and tell about their first kiss. and a fascinating look at Humans of the House, the new podcast that gives Canadians an extensive sneak peek behind the political curtain. Stick around. You're listening to The Social Podcast on the iHeartRadio Canada Network. Download the show wherever you find your favorite podcasts. And make sure to catch The Social weekdays at 1 p.m. on CTV. Now back to your hosts, Melissa Grello, Cynthia Loist, Lainey Louie, and Jess Allen, alongside Gilmore Girls and Sullivan's Crossing actor Scott Patterson. Take it away, Mel.
To the show. So you might call this next topic out of this world. Hollywood producer Ryan Murphy said in an interview that at the same time that he was making American Horror Story, he moved into a house that was occupied by, he called, a spiritual presence. I think he was saying it was a ghost slash haunted. So paranormal experiences, Scott, have you had any?
You know, I did when I was 16. I actually had a, what they call, referred to as an astral projection.
What is that?
You come out of your body and then you start flying.
Like a near-death experience?
I don't think it was death. I just think it was...
Where was your body?
It was in a sleeping bag on the floor of my sister's house that she was renting with her boyfriend when she was going to Colorado State University in Fort Collins, Colorado.
Okay.
And I was 16 and I came out there for the summer.
So you were in the sleeping bag.
And I was getting into the sleeping bag and all of a sudden I was like, and I started flying through the clouds.
So was this willful?
I was in my body and I was like, this, and I was just flying
along.
Could
you see your body that was left behind?
I did not look down and see it, but when I was going through the...
You were Supermaning.
No, I was flat on my back.
Where'd you go?
I just went through the clouds.
Oh. Do you think... Okay,
for how long? For how long?
I went to 7-Eleven, got some beef jerky, came back.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And I did it again, because I didn't get the 7-Up, and I came back.
Was this willful, or it just happened to you?
No, it was not willful.
Did you party that night?
Like, I didn't
were
party.
Were you under any influence?
I didn't party hardy. No.
So you were totally sober?
I was totally sober.
So when you're looking back at this now, what do you think? Like, what do you think it was like a, you know, partially dreaming state? Or like, what do you, how do you
might
explain
have been,
it?
Maybe. But the thing is when I got to a certain point, I knew that if I went further, I wouldn't come back. And that the fear kicked in.
Oh, yes. Interesting. Yeah.
The fear kicked in and I willed myself back. So there was, it felt like an invisible umbilical cord that I was aware of that kept me safe. But if I kept going, it would break. So I went back in.
Has it ever happened since?
Oh, no.
No, so just the one time.
Once in New York City in a cab, there was a sort of a similar feeling that I get kicked out of a cab for being unruly. Okay. You can even imagine.
Sorry.
I didn't have the money.
Yeah.
So that was kind of like that.
Does it make
I didn't come back. Yeah. I just kept going.
Yeah.
Does it make you believe now, though, in other, like, you know, ghosts or paranormal and like all this kind of things? Are you sort of like...
First house I bought, the house I was talking, that a medium came. I have a friend who's a medium. She came in before the furniture came in. And went through, she just started darting around the house and I was in the living room, like, what is going on? She went upstairs and she came back downstairs excitedly and said, there are a lot of ghosts in here. There's a lot of people in here. So I had to buy extra furniture. So, you know, I had to buy lots of furniture, chairs, towels.
I can't believe you still bought that house.
Huge expense.
Oh, did you ever?
No, that's what's like, hey man, you know, I astral projected. Yeah. So I know your
You're
world.
You're invincible.
So I know your world. Yeah.
I know
and you
your
never
world.
Had any encounters with them in that home?
No, but my son did. When he, because my son was, I sold that house when he was 6. Okay, but he always saw people. He always said, Daddy, Mommy, there's an old lady down the hall.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And then my wife would look at me and go, what the hell's going on?
Yeah.
Well, there, you know, the new show that you're on this network, Sullivan's Crossing, it's that title now is going to take on a whole new meaning now that I'm thinking about it. But can we talk about it for a second? Because this is the brand new show. It just made its debut. Look at you guys. Can you tell us a little bit about the show?
So... I play a character named Sully Sullivan, and I own a campground in Nova Scotia. And it's been in my family since the late 1800s, but I'm estranged from my daughter, Maggie, played by the beautiful and extraordinarily talented Morgan Cohan.
Yeah, she was with us last week.
She's a bit, so you know, so you're in love. I fell in love immediately too. Everybody does and everybody will. So she is a big time neurosurgeon in Boston. Her life blows up. She comes out to maybe reconnect with me, maybe not. So her life is in disarray. So, so that's really where the story kind of kicks in. Is she going to get back together with her dad? And then she, you know, did you all know Chad Michael Murray? I knew him when he was 18, and then I reconnected with him on this show. And he's—I know that he's immortal. He's probably hundreds of years old because he hasn't changed in 20 plus years, right?
Wow.
He's the shock of the hair. I mean, he just looks exactly
the hair
the
does
same.
Look great.
Yeah,
are
yeah,
you kidding
looks great.
Me?
Yeah, the blowout.
I lost my hair; ended up on his head. And I think that's what happens. That's the deal he made with the devil. When people lose their hair, it goes on my head and it goes blonde.
Oh. Well, Scott, listen, what an absolute blast to have you here. Thanks for having some chat time with us.
So much fun. Thank you so much.
This is awesome.
What a blast.
Thank you. All right, if you cannot get enough of Scott, all right, it's Sullivan's Crossing, Sundays at 7, right here on CTV. Also watch it on ctv.ca and the CTV app as well. Hey, listen, we'd also like to welcome back actor, comedian, Miguel Rivas.
Yes! Hello! Thank you for having
welcome
me.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
Always love seeing you.
So people are sharing stories of their first kiss on Board Panda. And I thought, you know, we should join in on this. Anybody remember? Let's wind back the clock, Miguel. I don't know if your wife's watching or if that's problematic at all, but...
If it was my wife, that would be pretty sad. no, my first kiss was a deeply traumatizing and embarrassing experience for me. Me and my friend had this coordinated effort. We knew these two girls kind of liked us, me and my best friend, and we were like, we'll take them to the movie. We went to see the most romantic movie ever, Mortal Kombat 2. Annihilation.
And how old were you?
I was 12. Maybe 11. And the plan was that my friend would take his girlfriend, heavy air quotes, not a girlfriend, to go get popcorn, and they would kiss out there, and we would be left alone to kiss in the movie theater. None of that happened in any capacity. And instead, as the credits were rolling on Mortal Kombat, we was like, 1, 2, 3, do it. And the girls were like, it was allowed to happen, but it was like, you guys are losers. People say they did not become our girlfriends.
There was a countdown.
It was more of a nod, like.
Let's do it. We can't let this movie end without Ryan.
This is it. Let's go.
I do feel for guys, like, in that heterosexual context, because I hope this is changing, but there was still such a pressure for the guy to make the first move. And if you weren't suave...
I was not.
Then you had problems,
very unsuave.
Right? The first guy who ever kissed me was in the stairwell of our elementary school. I was around 12.
Aww.
He was Italian and he was suave. I have to say, like this was clearly not his first time. Probably there had been another girl in this exact same spot. But it was a good kiss. I will say that like a little while later, I had another kiss with a different guy, and it was right outside, and it was a lot sloppier and a lot more aggressive and too much tongue, and it was right by where the buses line up, you know? And someone told my mother that they saw me making out with this guy named James out there. And
was it the first guy who kissed you?
No, it was. Oh, yeah, maybe.
Trying to get you in trouble?
It was terrible.
What did your mother do?
Oh, she was really mad. I don't remember. I blocked it out. She's very mad.
Do you remember yours?
Stairwell. 11.
Yeah.
Oh. And he was 12, and it was a good kiss. For me, it was a good kiss. It's just a bad setting. Like, most people I know, their first kiss, I mean, you were glamorous. You went to the movie theater.
The movies.
But it's, like, either in the gym or by the lockers or in the stairwell. It's not like, I always associate those places with smell.
Yeah.
Your schools smell, yeah. Right? Yeah. So anyway, yeah.
Bad lighting.
The kiss was good.
I'm glad. My first kiss was amazing. It was so good. His name was Steven, and it was behind a high school, the town's high school, and we weren't even going out. It was sort of orchestrated where there was like, oh, well, she has never had a kiss before. Oh, well, Steven has. And somehow the friends orchestrated this moment. They all kind of scattered like mice, and all of a sudden I turned around. I said, where'd all my friends
kids
go?
Are so
I'm sorry,
weird.
I'm sorry, right?
Kids
did
are
you,
so
wait, 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 did you consent to this?
Yes, of course.
Oh, okay, okay,
so I knew it was gonna happen.
It was a project? It was like
their
a Let's
project.
Kiss Melissa project?
No, I think they all kind of worked it out that Steven was available and he's clearly experienced.
See, there was always one.
There's always one, and Melissa really wanted to have her first kiss because I
was
never-
Was everybody watching?
No, no, they scattered.
Okay, okay, got
and
it.
And it was so good. To this day, I remember it, and I was 12 years old, so it matters.
It matters.
It's kind of like
matters.
Meet me at the flagpole for a fight, is what this sounds like. But yes. It was a kiss.
Good for you, Steven.
Oh, there it is. Miguel, what a blast. Thanks for joining
Thanks
us, for as always.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you. Thank you. Thanks for being here.
After the break, violent threats, panic buttons, and RCMP protection. Former members of Parliament Lisa Raitt and Selena Caesar Chavon open up about their scary realities while serving our country. Next week on The Social, the latest jewelry trends and how to style them. Plus, Dr. Cliff, the worldwide vet, tells us about his work traveling the world saving animals. The Social, weekdays at 1 p.m. on CTV.
Welcome back, everybody. So when it comes to Canadian politics, it can often feel like we are on the outside looking in. Well, there's a new podcast called Humans of the House, and it wants to flip that script.
The show features candid exit interviews with former MPs, giving Canadians an extensive sneak peek behind the political curtain. We have the podcast host Sabrina Dellen in studio with us today, as well as two former MPs featured on the show, Lisa Raitt and Selena Caesar Chavon. It's great to have all of you here.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Sabrina, okay, understatement. Conversations around politics can be divisive. Yeah. And uncomfortable, but you see these exit interviews as like an antidote to that, right?
Yeah, you bet. Conversations about politics can be intimidating. They can be really difficult. But Humans of the House is not just about a party or a policy. It's about the human side of politics, which is something we can all relate mm-hmm. to. So in our show, we interviewed a dozen former members of parliament. And because they're not in the job anymore, they can speak very freely. And they do. They share such powerful stories, not just about what needs fixing in our politics, but what's good and can be even better. You're going to hear MPs, former MPs, like you've never heard them before, being so open about their experiences that it wasn't uncommon for them to become emotional in our conversations. Mm-hmm. In the show, you're going to hear a lot of honesty and hope. And, you know, it's not from people who are observing politics, but from those who have lived it.
Mm. So let's get into a little bit of it, because we've got some of your guests from the podcast. Lisa, we're going to start with you. So you served as a federal cabinet minister and MP for 11 years.
there's a reaction.
I love that reaction right out of the gate.
Yeah.
Now, you say you didn't experience gender discrimination inside the House of Commons. However, right. you do say it was getting there. That was a different story. So can you explain that distinction for us?
Yeah, so serving Parliament, capital P Parliament, you get in there and you are paid exactly the same as the person sitting next to you. You had to go through exactly the same process to get where you are. You had to go through a general election. And you have exactly the same rights to stand up and speak in the House when you want to speak. That is all really good. That's where you feel equal. Selena and I were talking about it. I mean, in certain areas, you may not be as equal within your party, for sure. But in Parliament, you can. But getting there is tough. You have to make it through a nomination process. And that can be really unnerving and especially difficult if you're a woman, if you're racialized, if you don't have those connections within your community of the traditional politicians, it's really tough to get that nomination. But once you're there, you can make it work.
Hmm. You know what, Selena, though? You know... Your experience is a little bit different, maybe even the opposite from Lisa. So you served as an MP for 4 years. You say that getting there wasn't the issue. It was once you got there, you faced a lot of discrimination.
Yes.
Explicit or implicit?
I would say it's absolutely explicit. And so getting there, serving the people of Whitby, getting elected by a community that was wonderful to serve, was the easy part for me. It was getting in and then noticing in retrospect, because you're kind of dancing around in your head, is this really happening? Is this really what's going on? But noticing that I was picked to go to 3 events over the year as parliamentary secretary that were related to Black community. Mm. and then looking back and going, no, I wasn't imagining this. This is actually what happened. But knowing full well that you still have to navigate the political, you know, circus and still do your job as a member of parliament or parliamentary secretary in a way that upholds our democracy and upholds the truths and the trust that people have put into you in that particular role.
Fascinating. Sabrina, you're the executive director of the Samara Center for Democracy. And what I find fascinating is that your organization actually used machine learning and you were measuring the toxicity received by political candidates on social media. Mm-hmm. I mean, you could just imagine, right? So you looked at that with specifically how that could be a barrier to civic engagement. So tell us a little bit about the biggest things that stood out to you from that research.
Yeah, we used a bot to track toxic tweets received by candidates in Canadian elections. And when we looked at the 2021 federal election, we looked at 2.5 million tweets. 20% of those were toxic. To break that down, 140,000 tweets contained sexually explicit content. Almost 300,000 contained threats. This is coming at just about 300 candidates, and that's not spread evenly. It's going to be disproportionately felt by people who are underrepresented in our democracy, women, people of color. And, you know, a startling and alarming finding there is just that it's normal. This is normal as a condition of work for people who are pursuing the role of being a politician. It's normal in other professions as well. Journalism in the media, I'm sure, is relatable for you too. And that's something we need to think about because it's gonna affect representation in our democracy. Mm-hmm. If you see someone from your community that's underrepresented getting that online, you're gonna hold back from possibly voting, being civically engaged in other ways, and maybe running yourself. Mm-hmm.
So those are the statistics, but I think it's also important to understand how those statistics read while they were experienced by a real person, like you, Lisa.
Yeah.
So what happened was that when you were an MP, you were the recipient of all kinds of toxicity, and you were even accosted in person. Yeah. You received death threats.
Yeah.
What protective measures were available to you?
So once the RCMP have determined that whatever threats you're receiving do show that there's a risk to the individual, and I was a cabinet minister at the time, they will go to your house and they'll take a look around and determine whether or not there's appropriate lighting. Do you have a safe room? Do you have a panic button? Those things were provided for me. They wanted to put like a 20-foot pole up in my backyard with a giant light on it. My neighbor said, oh, I don't think so, Lisa.
Yeah.
That's not going to happen. So we tried that, and at the end of the day, I ended up having, because of the threat that happened for real, I had close protection, meaning I had an RCMP officer, but my kids were 10 and 7.
Yeah.
And we were going to wrestling on the weekends. Yeah. So the RCMP officer came with us to WWE. Mm-hmm. And that, I think they had a good time. You know,
wow.
We didn't have to pay for his ticket.
I know, but that's your life. Like, that's your children.
That was my,
and that's the thing. Yeah. A panic room in your house
we
is not...
One.
That's your job, and that's, I think, what people need to connect here.
Yeah. But it gets to, you got to be a really high level of threat.
I mean.
Twitter doesn't cut it.
Yeah. Twitter doesn't cut it. Selena, like so many MPs and Lisa's story, you were also the target of violent threats as well. So what kind of protection was offered to you?
Yeah, so counter to or similar to Lisa, but I wasn't a cabinet minister, so I, my local police services, so I want to give a shout out to Durham Regional Police Services, who I had a panic button for what seemed like years, because you're walking around with this thing in your pocket and you're afraid, you know, sometimes 11 o'clock at night, it's freezing in Ottawa, you're shaking and you're afraid that you might just click the button, but you have to walk around with that. And the threat was against myself and my children.
Yeah.
So we had posters put up in our local schools of the individual. And then, of course, that individuals are apprehended en route to Ottawa with a weapon. Oh, and so I do want to shout out to our local police departments, Parliamentary Precinct, and others who were involved in that apprehension. But it's a very real situation that I would never want to live through again, and it's making me emotional thinking about it now.
Wow. Well, thank you for sharing that. I know that's not easy to relive in any capacity. Well, Sabrina, it's clear that the working conditions in the House of Commons, there's many aspects of it that, you know, we've heard maybe are okay, but a lot that needs to evolve as well. So you've done these exit interviews, and you've done them for over 10 years, which is phenomenal. And so what do you see now as the urgent call
that really perhaps is right at the top of the list that needs to be addressed immediately?
Yeah, the House of Commons, we hear this over and over again in our exit interviews, is that the House of Commons was built for a different time. And it's in desperate need of an evolution, and we need safe and sustainable working conditions so that we can attract and hold on to the leaders that we need. If we want more Lisas running, more Selenas running, others from the diverse communities that Canada has running and staying and representing our interests in the House of Commons, we need safe and sustainable working conditions for them, because what happens to them affects all of us, the people that they serve.
100%. Lisa, quickly, the advice that you give people entering politics is to think about their exit plan.
Yeah.
And we don't often really hear about what life is like afterwards. So what is life like after?
Unemployment, right away. That day that you run in the election and you lose, you don't get paid for that day. Your employment is cut off. So my kids are behind me and they're celebrating because they're so happy I'm not elected anymore. But in the meantime, I'm trying to figure out how am I going to pay the mortgage. Yeah. So you gotta make sure that you manage yourself when you're in the house, to make sure that you can get a job after you're done in the house, because you will be done.
That's what people need to know.
Wow. Selena, it's wild because I'm hearing all of these stories and yet you say it was 100% worth all of this trouble.
Yeah.
To have gone through this whole process in politics. So listen, there are women watching right now thinking like, could I, would I, should I?
Yes.
What's the advice to someone who might want to do this?
I would say run, run in packs.
100%.
Take the lessons that we've brought, that others have brought, add it to your skills, your expertise, and show up as 110% yourself, knowing that you deserve to be there. Run like you're hungry, run like wolves, run with compassion and care. And use all of that energy to change our democracy, because you add women, you don't only change politics, you change everything, if not the world.
Thank you so much, all three of you, Selena, Sabrina, Lisa. It's been great having you on the show, and we want to let our viewers know the first episode of Humans of the House out right now. Go listen wherever you find your podcast.
You've been listening to The Social Podcast on the iHeartRadio Canada Network. The conversation continues on The Social. That's weekdays at 1 p.m. on CTV. Join us.
Don't miss a fiery debate. Subscribe to The Social Podcast on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your favorite shows. Until next time, socialites.